You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And it was on April 25th, back in 1990, that the Hubble Space Telescope was deployed in space from the Space Shuttle Discovery. Can you believe it?
Hooray!
That was 19 years?
Oh, my God. 19 years.
Remember what a cluster that was?
Yeah.
Oh, when they determined that they had this spherical
star
aberration?
Yep.
Yeah, right? I remember all the late-night comedians were just totally ragging on it for weeks. It was horrific.
You know where that lens was made?
Connecticut.
In Connecticut.
Yeah. Danbury, Connecticut.
Danbury, Connecticut. Yeah. Right where we live. That's right.
That's right. They could work. I think they only worked on it in certain hours of the day because of the truck vibrations on the highway.
That's what the problem was.
Nearby. So they worked on it only at night due to less traffic. It was big, you know, big news around here for a long time. And the anticipation was huge.
So the Hubble telescope went on to do incredible things, take incredible photographs. So it was a minor hiccup in the beginning, but they fixed it.
Yeah.
Yep. Luckily.
In the glasses.
Yeah, that's right.
But speaking of gorgeous pictures, the Cassini probe has been sending back absolutely stunning photographs of Saturn and its rings and moons.
Oh, man. Could you imagine living out there on one of those moons and being able to see that as your view?
Yeah, I remember when Carolyn Porco came to TAM one year and showed photographs of Cassini stuff, and it was just jaw-dropping. So cool.
There's one shot of the rings that you're seeing a sliver of the planet, and then the rings are going across the face of the planet, and they look ghost-like, and they're beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful pictures I've seen. It's incredible.
I like the picture of Iapetus, and you could see the ridge. You know, because Iapetus is like walnut shaped. It's got a ridge that goes all the way around it, and it's a very close up picture. Incredible. So at a distance of 2,400 miles, which is nothing,
wow.
And you can see this huge
very cool
ridge
stuff.
Going around the moon.
There are 61 known moons orbiting Saturn. They just keep discovering more. I think when I was in school learning about this, it was maybe in the 20s or 30s, but.
And if you remember, last week we were saying that we know that science works because it delivers the goods, as Carl Sagan said. And these are the goods. This is, you know, we could send a hunk of metal, you know, millions of miles away and get back these very pictures of Saturn and its rings and moons.
Yeah, you don't see a little spaceship powered by homeopathy putting by taking snapshots.
Right. And there's another bit of cool space news from just this last week. The search for interesting and increasingly Earth-like exoplanets continues to progress, and now we've discovered the yet again smallest exoplanet. This is Gliese 581e. So in the naming convention that they're using, the letter A is attached to the star itself. B would be the first exoplanet in that system discovered, then C, D, etc. So this is the fourth exoplanet of this star, Gliese 581. And this planet they discovered is only 1.9 times the size of Earth.
Wow.
That's getting awfully close to the size.
Size in terms of what? Diameter or density or what?
I think it's weight. This one's by mass, rather, mass.
Okay.
So, but it's not in the habitable zone. It's very close to its star, and it orbits in only a few days. Not 20 hours like that last one that was discovered. But astronomers are predicting that within a couple of years, we're going to be finding truly Earth-sized exoplanets, hopefully farther out from their stars. So, again, the holy grail is to find an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of its system so that it might actually contain liquid water and therefore potentially life.
What method did they use to discover? Was it the transit method? Or
this is the wobble method, I think.
Okay.
Looking at the wobble in the parent star by the mass effect of the planet.
That's pretty good then, because it's such a low-mass planet. Wow.
Yeah, but the closer it is, the planet is to the star, the more wobble you get. So you can find big worlds farther out or smaller worlds closer in. That's why we need to refine the methods before we could find Earth size, you know, far enough out to be in the habitable zone. And, of course, the transit method is also the same thing. The bigger the planet and the closer it is to the star, the more light it blocks as it transits across the star, and therefore the easier it is to detect. So that's why we have to refine these methods.
I'm really hoping, and I know that this is such an incredible long shot, but God, I would love to see an alien, and I would love to hear like what their language would be like if they even had an audible language, you know. But God, could you just imagine how profound that would be?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be a biped, you know? Like, there was a book that we looked at. Remember, Bob, that it was at Steve's house a long time ago? Actually, I think Michael Whalen made a drawing in it, but it had all these different aliens in it.
Like an alien encyclopedia. Was it aliens from science fiction novels, right?
Just
visual and representations of aliens. Yeah.
And one of the aliens had like a sphere that it sat on and rolled around, and they were insanely fit. There was just the fantasy of what these aliens would do. But it didn't have legs or anything. It had like a stone that it grew, that it rolled on. It had, you know, with its muscles, it was able to like basically like a giant bowling ball roll around on top of that. And I just thought it was I thought that was really cool, but I also thought it was really implausible.
Yeah, well, but the bottom line is we don't know. We don't know how typical or atypical life on Earth is.
We've got one data point.
And for the most part, I think that – I know you guys are big Star Trek fans or whatever, but you look at Star Trek and the aliens they have on there, I think it shows just a stunning lack of imagination.
Oh, for Star Trek? Yeah.
Yeah, that everybody is – for the most part is – bipedal, and you know, maybe there's something funky on your forehead. And
But they explain that.
I know.
They
I'm going to see the movie. See the movie too, Rebecca. So I can't wait.
But basically, any alien that you think is hot and you could be attracted to, that's unimaginative. That's not a plausible alien in my book.
Mm. Yeah, but you got to go back to the 1960s with Roddenberry, and first off, the budget limitations and the relative, you know,
I'm not saying there's
nature.
No other reason for it, but. I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously, like, but no, I think it still shows a lack of imagination. I think there are plenty of shows.
I agree.
Other things,
but with Roddenberry, one of his key things though was that you need eyes and you need a mouth. You got to be able to relate emotionally to these characters in some way, so that you have good drama, so that the show is interesting. Otherwise, you know, it's hard to get emotionally involved in a talking.
No, what about the Horta? You know? The Horta broke my heart, man.
No kill eye.
Yeah, but how did you interpret no kill eye? But I'm just saying that's what he was thinking. That's what Roddenberry was thinking. But yeah, you could do a good job with something that's not totally anthropomorphic.
Yeah, well, Bob, remember that one episode on the Next Gen when that one alien goes, "Ugly bags of mostly water," and he's talking about humans. I remember Bob and I were looking at, we saw.
Well, let's go on to the next item. We're going to talk a little bit about the Huffington Post. This is
the HuffPo.
The HuffPo.
Yeah, I say.
So the Huffington Post is an online newspaper and blog host.
With a liberal slant.
It does have a liberal slant, although it's not something that we care about. But what it does have is a completely pseudoscientific slant. And it's really getting terrible. It's really getting – you know, I've been reading articles on the Huffington Post because it's been a focal point of anti-vaccinationist writing for a long time. But now they're going – far beyond that. It seems as if it's not just the usual low-quality science journalism where you have false balance or you have someone who's not a scientist who doesn't know how to interpret or really put into context the stories that are coming out. Rather, you have people writing articles and blogs for the Huffington Post that are anti-scientific and that have either an anti-vaccinationist agenda or an anti-mainstream medicine agenda. So it's really the editorial policy, it seems, of the Huffington Post to do this. There were three articles just in the last few days that, you know, a lot of our listeners have been emailing me, some of which I've already written about. And just to give you an example, so these are the three ones that have been out recently that people have been emailing us about. One was an article written by Kim Evans, and the title of this post is "Antibiotics Cause Cancer?" with a question mark. Ugh.
How many millions of people have antibiotics saved?
Right.
Do we really need some anti-science loon, you know?
Yeah, she's a loon.
She's
a total loon. So this is the case that she builds, right? That and the scientific illiteracy she demonstrates in her writing is profound. I mean, you just have to read it. She She calls the bacteria that colonize our bodies probiotics. That's that's wrong. Probiotics are like products like yogurt that have bacterial cultures in it. Right. It's not the name of the bacteria. Then she said, this is a great one, that healthy bacteria form the basis of our immune system.
What?
Well, I know, that's what everyone...
Really?
What?
That's oh, my God. Right now, Mark Crislip is throwing up on his shoes.
He's so, throwing up all that bacteria.
They the healthy bacteria crowd out bad or more malicious bacteria, but they don't form the basis of our immune system. You know, your own cells form the basis of your immune system. This is just one sort of passive layer of defense.
Wow.
Then she says that, so after basically trumping up the role that these healthy bacteria play in our immunity, she says that when people take antibiotics, it kills off these bacteria. Again, there's a kernel of truth to that, although she totally exaggerates it. Sure, if you take broad-spectrum, really big-gun antibiotics for a long time for a serious infection, it could significantly decrease your normal bacterial ecosystem, and that can leave you vulnerable to other infections until you have a chance for it to recover. But she makes it sound like this is basically what happens routinely whenever you use any antibiotics, and that your bacteria never recovers. What does happen, she argues, is that you get candida, which is a fungus, and that 90% of the population has candida overgrowth, which is a complete distortion. 90% of people are colonized with candida. It's just another part of the ecosystem.
Right.
But it's not 90% of people don't have an infection or an overgrowth of candida. That is complete nonsense. But she's just setting you up for the big woonis. This is all headed is that this candida overgrowth is what causes all cancers.
Oh, man. Isn't that what a red flag that is?
Any cause for all disease or all cancer or all anything is always a big red flag. And she's getting this from Dr. Tullio Simoncini, who is a notorious cancer quack, who claims that candida causes all cancer, and he can cure all cancer by treating...
With antifungals?
By treating the candida. It's completely absurd. This is also all a thinly veiled infomercial for her book on cleansing toxins from your body.
Surprise!
There we go.
So the Huffington Post is basically...
Now, wait a minute. She's butting in on Kevin Trudeau's territory here. What is going on? I think Kevin Trudeau's lawyers might be paying her a visit soon.
Yeah. Zero credibility. So, and then the next day there was another article by Margaret Ruth on intuitive scanning. So this is on medical intuitives. You guys ever hear of this?
Mm-mm.
So they're basically psychics who say they could read your body energy. They could see where the energy isn't flowing, and they make their diagnosis based upon that.
I don't need a doctor anymore.
Yeah, right. It's just another form of cold reading.
You guys are probably not girls, and so you don't know that on Oprah, medical health intuitives are everywhere. Like the big one is Dr. Christiane Northrup, and she is presented as this great gynecologist who's going to teach all the women in the audience to get in touch with their inner woman, and it's all about health and
empowerment.
It's just such BS. It's about empowerment, and it's sold to women as something that we're just supposed to accept because it's going to make us feel special and good about our vaginas. And so I think that these medical intuitives focus mostly on women and often to our detriment, because it's basically just psychic in a nicer term that's not as woo sounding.
Can they help me get in touch with my inner woman?
You can't go within 30 feet of your inner woman, so they probably can't help you.
Oh, okay. It's like a restraining order. Yeah.
Yes. And before we get off the topic of Huffington Post, we have to talk about Jim friggin' Carrey.
Well,
right?
That's where I'm going next. Yeah. So then today, Jim Carrey graduates from just being the boyfriend of an anti-vaccinationist kook to being a full-fledged anti-vax kook himself.
Oh no!
Yeah, he wrote this long article. Just the judgment on vaccines is in three question marks, and he repeats the standard talking points of the day of the anti-vax movement, you know, right down the line. It's really disgusting. I think all the points we've pretty much already addressed before, but I noticed in particular he repeats the toxin gambit. He writes, while ingredients like aluminum, mercury, ether, formaldehyde, and antifreeze may help preserve and enhance vaccines, they can be toxic as well. Ether and antifreeze are not in vaccines. That has been debunked for months publicly to McCarthy and Kerry. And the fact that he continues to repeat that demonstrable lie really shows, you know, how intellectually, you know, devoid this whole thing is. Formaldehyde, we make formaldehyde in our own bodies in greater amounts than in vaccines. Next, viruses. We get more viruses just by getting colds and just by from the environment than what you're getting in vaccines. It really is an insignificant addition to the overall exposure of our immune systems. It's just highly, highly targeted.
I don't know, Steve. He's an actor making like $20 million a movie. I know what you say. You have facts, data, but he's
all the conspiracy theory stuff going. Yeah, he's just talking out his ass. All the conspiracy mongering things again, fear mongering. It's total crap and nothing new.
What qualifies him to even put these words down? So presumptuous. Oh my gosh, self-importance.
It's the arrogance of ignorance. He's too ignorant to realize how ignorant he is, and therefore that leads to excessive arrogance in his own opinions.
Horrific.
Well, Steve, this guy J.B. Handley, man, he thinks you're an idiot.
Yeah, I'm getting there. You want me to go to that one next?
We might as well jump right to that because he's pretty much Jim Carrey, only focused on you.
Very good segues tonight. I applaud you all, by the way.
So, J.B. Handley is the founder of a website called The Age of Autism, which is a notorious anti-vaccination site and organization. Now, the front people for that site is Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey. Handley basically allowed them to take the front position because they're famous, you know, even though he founded it. Somehow, he discovered that I write blog entries about the anti-vaccination movement. He just discovered who I am. And that prompted him to write a really mean, low, disgusting personal attack against me.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's really objectionable.
Yeah, it was remarkably base. And for instance, attacking the fact that, you know, he goes on Yale's website and finds that Steve deals with botulism in order to, you know, used as an actual treatment.
Right.
And then he talks about how scary and evil botulism is. And the funny thing is, like, I'm reading over this, I'm like, hi, Jenny McCarthy injects it into her face.
Right.
Like, oh God.
So that's about the level of what he was doing. He was basically trying to say, to impugn my reputation, my professionalism, my credibility by saying that I inject people with Botox, with botulinum toxin, and how awful and toxic and dangerous it is, and also that it's used for cosmetic purposes, even though it's completely obvious from the very sources he was quoting, you know, the Yale website, that I don't use it for cosmetic purposes. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm a neurologist. I use it for neurological indications. But somehow
cosmetic,
he tries to tie me to the fact that I'm using the same drug that's also used by other people for cosmetic purposes. It's just a huge non sequitur, and it's obvious he's just trying to smear me with whatever he thinks he can grab onto.
Wow.
It was totally pathetic. But the good news is that he does such a bad job of it, and he totally exposes his own ignorance so completely that it was a pleasure for me to dismantle his nonsense.
And can I just point out too, like, before he even gets to, you know, he does eventually get around to the facts, like addressing the actual facts that you bring up about autism and vaccines. But in addition to the botulism thing, he also opens up by saying that your particular work has nothing to do with autism. Your work is something else entirely, even though that, yes, you know, you do have all this training, but it's not in the specific fields of vaccinations. And then he goes on to say that he, as a business major, is somehow qualified more so than you are to comment on this. I just, That was just jaw-dropping to me.
Like, yeah, it was a direct contradiction. It gets like the kettle defense. Right. He's grasping at anything. He says, this novella guy doesn't know what he's talking about because even though he's a neurologist, he is not an expert in autism or vaccines. And then he goes on to say, and those experts don't know anything. I know better because I have street smarts and I'm a businessman. So right. Does expertise matter or not? It matters when you want it to matter, but for me, but not for you. You know, people should listen to you with no science training, but not me, because I only have some science training. It doesn't make any sense.
Does he have Jenny McCarthy's mommy instinct?
Yeah, he has autism instincts.
Yeah, right.
After reading Handley's article, I would really appreciate it if he didn't do a personal attack to the level that he did. It's one thing to take a jab here and there or whatever, but he does take it too far, and I really would like him to just go blow for blow and really go back and forth with you, Steve, and take the points for what they are and let you guys argue over them or discuss them. But, you know, he brings it down to a level where, you know, you just get insulted when you read it.
Yeah. But, Jay, he can't stand toe-to-toe with me on the points. He can't, because he doesn't have the points. That's why he goes through this long non sequitur ad hominem attack and makes up stuff. This is the level of the stuff that he's getting at. He says, looking at his biography on Wikipedia, which he undoubtedly wrote himself. Now, I got to say, I love it when people are absolutely certain about something that's demonstrably false. So in my blog response, I said, this is a small point in itself, but it reveals Handley's intellectual laziness and clear bias. He tries to imply something about my ego by expressing his lack of doubt that I wrote my Wikipedia entry. Apparently, Handley lacks the internet chops or the minimal intellectual curiosity it would have taken to click the history tab on my Wikipedia page. If he had, he would have seen that the entry was contributed to by many people, none of them me.
Nice.
One click away, and he couldn't even do that. So, you know, when I'm going to tear somebody down, I make sure I get my ducks in a row, right? I make sure I have the actual facts on my side. He obviously does not care about the facts. He can't be bothered to spend one click, you know, before he can justify an accusation that he wants to make. But eventually, after these ridiculously irrelevant attempts at smearing me, he gets to the actual blog entry and the points that I was making, and he completely blows it. And I love it when people blow it to this extent. After calling me arrogant and going all through that all the relevant stuff and some conspiracy stuff with the CDC, then he comes back to my study, right? And he missed all of my actual points, and I was criticizing in my article a new initiative by the anti-vaccine movement called this 14 Studies website, where they take the 14 big studies, and it's not that there are only 14 studies, but they're like, there are 14 prominent studies that we say show a lack of correlation between MMR or thimerosal or vaccines and autism, and they basically try to shoot them down. They do that by completely rigging the game. They come up with these bogus criteria, and literally the criteria are things that amount to, we don't think they're asking the right question, and we've criticized it before, therefore it's been criticized. So that's points against it. Or the trivial conflicts of interest that they say they use to dismiss any study. Oh, that was funded by the CDC, and they hate, you know, they hate kids and like vaccines, so that's biased. So they completely trump up this ridiculous scale in order to criticize all of these studies, and they completely misrepresent them. So David Gorski and I wrote a pair of blog entries on science-based medicine. David set it up with showing how ridiculous their criteria were and went through a number of the studies, and I did some follow-up commentary and focused on just one study that David didn't cover. This was a Danish study which showed that – looked at like 30 years of data and thousands of kids, and showed that autism rates were flat in the 70s and 80s. And during that time, right in the middle of that time, the amount of thimerosal was almost cut in half around 1970, but that didn't have any effect on autism rates. And then in 1991, thimerosal was removed completely from vaccines in Denmark. And then in 1992, autism rates started to increase. They obviously were not increasing because of thimerosal, because the thimerosal had already been taken out of the vaccines. So what does this show? It shows that the autism diagnostic rates increased in Denmark even after thimerosal was removed. So you can't, it doesn't make sense to blame the same increase going on at the same time in the United States on the presence of thimerosal, but that's exactly what the anti-vaccination movement did. It also showed that dropping the dose almost in half didn't affect autism rates. So there's essentially no correlation in this data between what was happening with the thimerosal and these vaccines, or the vaccine schedule itself, and autism. What was happening was the same phenomenon that was happening in Western, you know, industrialized nations, was it changes in the definition of autism and the surveillance for autism over the same exact period of time caused autism rates to increase. So that's the point that I made. Hanley doesn't actually address any of those points. What he does is he focuses on a mistake that he thinks that I made and tries to make it seem like I'm an idiot because of this, right? I said that autism rates in Denmark were similar to that in the United States. Hanley says, but if he had read the paper, like a fifth grader who read the paper could have seen that the autism rates in Denmark were only 5 per 10,000, while in the United States they were 60 to 80 or 60 to 100 per 10,000. Therefore, Novella thinks they're similar because there was a 20 to 25-fold increase. Right, so he goes on and on about what an idiot I am because I'm a liar or whatever. But here's the thing: he was comparing incidence rates in Denmark to prevalence rates in the United States. Right, the incidence is how many kids of a certain age group in 1 year are newly diagnosed with autism. Prevalence rates were how many people are there right now who have autism. Prevalence rates are usually, depending on how chronic or long-lasting a diagnosis would be, are much higher than incidence rates. So guess what? The prevalence rates are the same in Denmark over the same periods of time as they were in the United States. There are about 80 per 10,000 in the year 2000 in Denmark, about 80 to 100 in the United States. They're similar. They're about the same. He completely blew it by comparing incidence to prevalence. So after going through this all this argument about how experts don't necessarily know what they're talking about and he has street smarts and that matters most, he makes an absolutely rookie mistake because he doesn't understand how to look at statistics and he gets it completely wrong.
Sounds like he set up a pretty big straw man there too.
He did, yeah. So, I mean,
Oh, yeah.
So, he handed that to me on a silver platter, you know.
Thank you.
That it doesn't get more clear cut than that, and I was able to provide references which he didn't bother to do, showing that they were basically the same in the U.S. and Denmark. And again, that's actually a side point; it's actually not relevant to the points I was making. It just shows that he's intellectually lazy. His scholarship is absolutely sloppy. He's completely biased, and he's just cherry picking whatever factoids he thinks he can grab onto, whether or not they're actually accurate or real, in order to make his point.
Well, at least he's got that business degree to fall back on.
So I challenged him to publicly correct that accusation or further expose his intellectual dishonesty.
What's your guess, Steve? What's going to happen?
He'll either ignore my reply or he'll just write something even more ridiculous. I mean, sometimes he backs down, meaning just by ignoring it if he gets called out. But he's not engaged in a real intellectual discussion, right? Like Jay asked, shouldn't you guys just go point for point? Yeah, Jay, if we were, we are, but if they were interested in the truth, in actually understanding the data and coming to some kind of mutual understanding, we can settle our differences. Our differences are about evidence and science. What is, I want to know if vaccines are causing autism. I have no stake in this. I have no dog in this hunt, right? I want to know what the truth is. And I just understand that, you need to look at scientific evidence to figure out what the truth is. If they were interested in that too, we could settle our differences, absolutely. But they're not interested in that. They're not interested in what's real or what's true. It's really a cult, and I'm not using that lightly. They're absolutely an ideological cult. They're completely insular. It's them against the world. They're the army of light. We're evil. We're all in the pockets of big pharma. We're either inept or corrupt. That's it. That's a black and white world. That's how they see it. And if you think I'm overstating it, go read the comments to Handley's article. Read his article.
Oh my gosh.
And then read the comments, and you will see an echo chamber of cult-like insular paranoia. and this self-righteous accusations. It's
the only thing
really
missing is a plate of cookies and a vat of Kool-Aid. That is all that is missing from this.
Right.
I like what he said in his article. I'm not intellectually intimidated by any of these jokers talking about Steve and other educated doctors. Yeah. Their degrees mean Zippo to me because I knew plenty of knuckleheads in college who went on to be doctors, and they're still knuckleheads.
Jay, did he write educated or edumacated?
Edumacated.
Is that like the argument from anti-authority?
Yeah, basically. It's basically playing the elitism card, and he uses the term elite often. That's always a red flag. It's like people who who pretend to have any kind of expertise or knowledge are just being elitist. But they could be idiots, too, and it's really us guys. We know what's really going on because we have street smarts. Of course, then he demonstrates that he doesn't know what's going on, and he makes really simple-minded mistakes that no self-respecting scientist would make. So it's just beautiful. So, I mean, again, I wear these kind of personal attacks from people like him as a badge of honor. You know, it's just like earning your skeptical bones, basically getting taken down like this. But it's... He so fully exposed his own hypocrisy and his own intellectual laziness that it's gold, really. I mean, it really, for anyone who is not already a true believer and who has the ability to see this for what it is, it really was an amazing display. So, Evan, tell us about this little legal trouble that Kellogg has gotten itself into.
Yeah, a little, like you said, a little legal trouble. But first, I'll take you back in the time machine a little bit. Back to July of 2008, when I was one night shopping for groceries in the grocery store. And I came across, I was down the breakfast cereal aisle, and I was getting some Cheerios for my daughter. She likes her favorite. And then there's the package right next to it, Kellogg's Frosted Mini Wheats. And on the front of the cover of the box, it says, clinically shown to improve kids' attentiveness by nearly 20%. That's a pretty bold claim, wouldn't you say?
20%.
20%. Clinically
shown. Seems like a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what they showed that if kids eat it, they're 20% more attentive in school?
Well, this is what the box said, Jay. And then there was a little footnote, which took me a long time to find. On the box, because you have to turn the box around, you're looking for the little footnote about which probably explains what this clinical study is and so forth. And there's all kinds of distractions like games to play and
you're easily distracted.
They're fun. I mean, all these word games and other puzzles on the back. So after completing all of those, I finally found the footnote way at the bottom. And the footnote read this: the combination of Kellogg's Frosted Mini Wheats, 8 layers of whole grains and fiber work together to keep kids full so they can stay focused throughout the morning. Fiber helps slow down the eating process and may contribute to a feeling of being full. Whole grains slow digestion of carbohydrates to release energy over a longer period of time.
So the kids aren't distracted by being hungry. Was that their justification for it?
Right. And their cereal is what did it for them. So... I delved into it a little bit more, and you go and you find out that what their study was, their clinical tests or their clinical trials, whatever they did, were performed by Kellogg's.
Yeah.
Of course, it was not some sort of there was no independent verification of any of this. This was their own processes that they went through, and that's what they came up with based upon independent clinical research, right? Which is Kellogg's. They said they had kids who had this cereal had an 18% better attentiveness for 3 hours after they ate breakfast compared to kids who ate no breakfast, right?
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, well, what the heck? I mean, what's the difference between that and, having a piece of fruit or having some other cereal or anything probably would have caused a difference in attentiveness as opposed to kids who eat nothing? Well, April 20th. And if you go to the FTC, Federal Trade Commission's website, and you read their title of their article, Kellogg settles FTC charges that ads for Frosted Mini Wheats were, in fact, false.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
The FTC, yep.
Flat out false.
The FTC got them. Yep. They were false.
Whoa.
So here's what the first paragraph reads. The Kellogg's company, world's leading producer of cereal, agreed to settle FTC charges that advertising claims touting the breakfast cereal, which was clinically shown to improve kids' attentiveness by nearly 20%, were false and violated federal law.
Did they disclose the amount that they, like, of a fine or anything?
It hasn't been determined yet. It's to be determined.
Yeah, I mean, the FTC has been doing a good job of cracking down on this kind of stuff because, you know, any company could do these worthless in-house studies, make some claims and say that they're clinically proven and have really little at risk for that. My complaint, though, which I always bring up when we talk about these types of topics, is that the fines are never big enough. Then they never really amount to a deterrent.
It's a cost of business.
Yeah, it comes down to the cost of doing business, but not really a deterrent. I mean, it has to be the kind of thing where we want companies, you know, company executives to think, if we get caught, you know, by this for the FTC, this is going to cost us more money than it's worth. So we just can't risk doing it. We got to keep things on the up and up.
And you know, a big company like Kellogg's, you know, obviously they make lots of products. Mm-hmm. It's on everyone's shelves and so
forth. They kind of have a wholesome reputation, but they're still just another company.
Did they really? I wonder how many more boxes of this cereal they wound up selling because of the claim. And if in the end, if it was really worth it, maybe it was. I don't know how many people actually paid attention to to that claim and bought it based on that. I imagine it was successful and that they
did. I'm sure they have very, very good data on that. That's something that companies do well. Joining us now is Seth Shostak. Seth, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Seth is a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And you've been there for – how long have you been there now?
You know, I have to think back. I think it was 1990 that I first joined the SETI Institute, plus or minus 1 year. So that's astronomical accuracy.
Right. So – and how's it going?
Well, I mean, you know, this is one of those quests which – you know, it's a bit uncertain. It's not for sure that you're actually going to find something. But on the other hand, if you do, it would be very exciting. And there are always new ideas. People have the idea that, you know, SETI is very repetitive. We're just sitting around with earphones on day after day. And, of course, it's nothing like that. But there are new ideas. There's new equipment. There are new approaches. And there's new data, like, you know, planets that have been found and so forth. So it's endlessly exciting.
You still happy that you went that route with your career?
Yes, I am, because it does give me a lot of freedom to do a lot of different things, actually. I am happy with it. It's a great group of people. As I say, it's almost a privilege. Well, it is a privilege to be able to work on a question that's everybody, just about everybody, is interested in, and we happen to be at a good time in history when you might be able to answer that question. So, you know, as I say, it's kind of nice to be able to do that. I could have been, you know, I could be doing air conditioning repair or something like that.
Right.
Probably more lucrative, but...
Seth, a lot of conspiracy-minded people believe that the government is hiding evidence of extraterrestrials visiting the Earth, and one of the reasons they invariably give is something like they don't want to cause a panic. What do you think would be the worldwide reaction to incontrovertible evidence that there is intelligence out there?
Well, I don't think that there would be worldwide panic. Look, you know, of course, I don't subscribe. Maybe I shouldn't say of course, but I don't subscribe to this idea that the aliens are visiting Earth and the government is keeping that from us. But on the other hand, you know, polls show that something like one-third of Americans believe that is true. So it's a very widespread belief. And as far as I could tell, I walked around the streets here today in Mountain View where I live. I didn't see anybody terribly upset about the fact that Earth is being visited, even though one in three of them think that it's happening. So I can hardly believe that if they picked up the newspapers tomorrow and read that, you know, we'd found a signal coming from very far away, that they would say, well, all right, that's reason enough to panic. I'm headed for the streets, you know, give me my cherry bombs and whatever else I need to riot in the streets.
Pitchforks and torches.
Yeah, but that is such a standard of the UFO believer culture, the notion that the purpose for the conspiracy is to prevent panic in the streets, which was never a compelling argument for me.
No.
But, you were on, I believe it was Larry King, maybe about 6 months or so ago.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? I remember that stuck out because you did such a wonderful job, I have to say. It's so hard as the being in the role of the skeptic to keep cheery and positive, but I think you pull that off wonderfully. So do you enjoy going up against the true believers in the UFO or other areas?
Well, it's, you know, it's I think there are good things about it, and there are some things that aren't necessarily so good. The good thing is that you get to present your side of the story, really, because the people who are saying that, look, the aliens are here. The government has the evidence. They've got it stacked up at Area 51 or some such place, right? They're pretty good at presenting that argument. They're very vocal. And, of course, if you're making a TV show about aliens, you know, these guys have got the goods. They're claiming the aliens not only exist, but they're here. Now, you got to say that story trumps the SETI story every time. The SETI story is, well, we think they're out there, but actually we haven't found them yet. Well, yawn. I mean, come on. Would you rather have the opportunity of improving your social life by having aliens haul you out of your bedroom at night? You know, if they're not here, then at least, you know, you don't get that opportunity. And it might not appeal to everyone, but if you're kind of lonely, maybe it does. I don't know. But in any event, so that's, you know, there's a reason that that story is so well told and so often told, because it's a more compelling story. But on the other hand, I think that people should also be exposed to the fact that very few scientists are convinced by the evidence. It isn't impossible that they could be here, although I often wonder why they're here now. But that isn't impossible. But on the other hand, if you're going to make that claim, then let's see the good evidence. And I don't think the evidence is very good.
Sure, but do you find that challenging to make the real science as exciting as the fake stuff in a public venue?
Well, challenging. I mean, yeah, I guess it is challenging. I happen to like explaining science to the public. There are a lot of people that find that an interesting thing to do. Not particularly special there. But, yes, it's a challenge to keep people interested, particularly not the ones that are already into this stuff. But if you're on a show like Larry King, you know, there are tens of millions of viewers out there who would just as soon see Paris Hilton talk about something as you. And so that's where the real challenge is. The challenge is not in making it interesting for people who are into the whole idea of space or UFOs or anything like that. The challenge in a venue like that is, can you make this interesting and possibly even educational? Terrible word to use, but, you know, to all the rest of the people who, as I say, would rather, you know, watch championship bowling.
Seth, part of the reason why we wanted to get you on the show this week was to talk about a recent op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times, in which you advocate robotic exploration of other solar systems. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, this all derived from a much simpler article, a shorter article that I had written for space.com, the website there. You know, that one simply pointed out the same thing I pointed out in the New York Times article, which was somewhat more refined, but that we have this idea that before the end of the century or whatever, we're going to send people into deep space, not to the moon or Mars, but that, you know, our destiny is to go to the stars. Well, that may be. I mean, I'd be the last one to argue against that. At some point, we probably have to go to the stars. You know, another couple of billion years, the sun's going to start going funny in a serious way. And we'll have strong motivation to get out of the neighborhood. But, you know, in the near future, near might mean 100, 200 years, something like that. I think it's very difficult because the distances are enormous. But the point was simply an observation that our remote sensing technology, our ability to send robots that function as our eyes and ears and any other part of your anatomy that you want, that technology is improving much, much faster than our rocket technology. So it just seemed to me that, well, you know, sending ourselves into space, that's hard and it takes a long time to get there and it's dangerous and people probably will want to, you know, return ticket and so forth. But sending robots that would allow us to explore these distant places, you know, in a sort of a virtual reality way, well, that kind of technology is almost here now. So the thought was, let's go to the stars, but let's not wait 500 or 1,000 years or whatever it might take. Let's go there earlier with our remote sensors.
So how much easier would it be to send a robot to a nearby system as opposed to a human being?
Well, for any given rocket, of course, the lighter you make it, I mean, the energy of the rocket is fixed, okay, and the energy gives you mv squared. In other words, if you can have the weight, then you get, you know, 40% more speed. Right? If you can reduce the weight by 100, you get 10 times the speed and so forth. So one of the advantages of sending robotic sensors rather than people is that they don't need to weigh as much as people. Now, it isn't that people weigh so much. Well, actually, these days they do. But, you know, I mean, people are a couple hundred pounds. But, you know, you need all this life support. You need the food, the water, the, you know, the all the stuff, the air.
Plus they want to come back.
Yeah, and if they want to come back, that's right. You got to worry about that, too. The robots don't insist on that, at least so far. And so you can make them really small. I mean, you can send something the size of a watermelon or a grapefruit that might do really a really good job of making photos for you. And you know, maybe not today, but 10 years from now or 20 years from now, you could probably do that without too much effort. Well, that's a heck of a lot smaller payload, which means that any given rocket could be shot at much higher speed. And so that's the idea. It can get there, you know, in 50 years or whatever, with the kind of rocket that you can envision today. And, you know, sending a person for 50 years in a rocket, that's a lot harder.
Now, although it was my understanding that using any kind of propulsion technology, if you have to carry your fuel with you, the weight of the fuel is the vast majority of the total weight that you'd be carrying, not the payload. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, there's something called the rocket equation, and it was worked out really, I mean, it's just some, you know, elementary physics, and it was worked out more than 100 years ago. And indeed, you're right, the final speed that you can reach, you know, the terminal velocity, if you will, they call it, how fast your rocket is actually going to cruise between here and there, depends on two things. It depends on how fast you're shooting whatever it is you're shooting out the back, right? On the one hand, you know, our chemical rockets shoot hot gas out the back, and it, you know, it moves at hundreds of miles an hour, thousands of miles an hour, something like that. But an ion rocket might shoot stuff out the back, you know, 100,000 times faster than that. In a photon rocket, which just has a flashlight on the back, you know, would be shooting stuff out at the speed of light. So those can get to much higher velocities. The other thing that counts is how much fuel you have on board, indeed, because obviously the more fuel you have, you know, you can get it up to higher speed because you can keep burning the rockets longer.
Right,
now,
right.
You know, it's true that if you look at the kind of rockets that take off routinely from the coasts of Florida there, you know, they're mostly fuel. It's mostly what the rocket is. It's just fuel, a whole lot of fuel. Very little payload up there.
While there would be an advantage to sending a small robot versus the life support system of a cabin for humans, the fuel is still ultimately the limiting factor, you think?
Well, it is for the kind of rockets we talk about today, but, you know, there are other designs. There are things called solar sails, for example, which, you know, are kind of what the name says they are, just big sails, and sunlight blows on them, not wind, of course. In space, the breeze is kind of restricted, but, you know, just the light. And if you sort of sail around the sun, you get close to the sun, you can get a big push from the sun. Okay, so in that case, you're not taking any fuel, but you do need a very big sail. So, you know, there's kind of a engineering challenge there. Another thing you can consider doing is having a rocket that just scoops up the gas between the stars and, you know, ignites it. I mean, it's mostly hydrogen, so you sort of have a hydrogen bomb kind of rocket. And you just have a big scoop on the front, and it scoops up this hydrogen gas, so, you know, you have endless fuel. It's like a horse.
Is that a Bussard ramjet, they call that?
Yeah, Bussard ramjet, indeed. And, you know, so just in the way a horse always can find fuel right in front of it, so could this. The trouble is that those scoops have to be tremendously large,
right,
many
right.
miles across. So, you know, that's a bit of a problem. And another way to do it is to maybe have a solar sail, but have a laser or just a mirror on the back of your rocket. You get your rocket up into space, and then it's just got a mirror in the back, and you use a powerful laser on the Earth to bounce light off that mirror, and it turns out that'll push your rocket, too. The trouble with that is somebody on the ground has to keep, you know, keep working this laser, mm-hmm. and if, for example, you have a budget cut or something, guys say, well, we've got to turn this laser off. We can't afford the power anymore. You know, the guys in the rocket might not appreciate that.
And even a laser beam would attenuate after hundreds and millions of miles. How far would a laser actually be helpful for a solar sail? What if you got out to Jupiter, Pluto?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But on the other hand, keep in mind you only have to accelerate it, you know, till you get it up to a decent speed, which might all happen fairly close to the Earth, and then after that you just cruise. Now there is the problem of coming back. There might not be handy aliens with a laser at the other end.
Right.
That sounds like a one-way trip.
Yeah.
What was most intriguing for me, though, what was most intriguing in the article was the, you mentioned the, specifically the nuclear-powered rockets, which to me, I'm fascinated by them. It's just something that seems so close. I mean, we've actually built working nuclear rockets in, I believe it was in the 50s and 60s, and but there was a nuclear test ban. Yeah, the partial test ban treaty, which outlawed outer space nuclear weapons, seemed to pretty much kill it. And to me, it seems like such a no-brainer, not just for these little microprobes to other star systems, but for humans to use in within our solar system. It just seems so much far superior to chemical rockets, and we're just not doing anything with it. It's so frustrating.
Well, it is, and yeah, I had mentioned that in my article because it seems like an obvious technology that you could adapt to this idea of, you know, send the robots rather than us to the stars, and we'll experience the stars robotically. It's true that, in fact, Freeman Dyson, a very well-known physicist now at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, was working on this project. I think he said in a recent New York Times piece that it was, you know, the best time of his life or something. But, you know, one way to build these things, a very straightforward way to build them, is just to throw atomic bombs out the back of your rocket and have a big pressure plate on the back and, you know, just have it explode against that pusher plate and keep pushing you forward. You can imagine that, you know, such a scheme would raise the hackles of a lot of people in society. But heck, if you're, you know, if you're out in space, who cares if you're detonating atomic bombs? So that was an easy way to do it, and it I'm sure it would work.
And there's other schemes as well, using the heat from the nuclear engine to heat hydrogen, and then use that as the exhaust gas. And there's lots of other ways to do it. I'm just waiting for the day when they finally say, "Yep, okay, let's do it again. We really need this technology."
Yeah, you're right, and as you've already alluded to, there have been plenty of good designs, and the answer to this, as is the answer to so many questions in the whole field of space travel, is somebody has to be willing to write the check. NASA barely has enough money to build new spacecraft to put people up to the International Space Station, so you know, this just isn't on the front burner.
So clearly you're an advocate of robotic exploration for other stellar systems.
Yes.
And I agree. It's going to be a long time before we're going to figure out how to make it plausible to send people. And I also agree that probably the near-term most viable technology for that would be nuclear-powered engines. But what are your thoughts, and we've had a lot of debate about this, what are your thoughts about exploration of our own solar system? Do you think we should also rely exclusively or heavily on robots, or should we be trying to put people on the moon, on Mars, and are populating our own solar system?
Well, that's the endless debate. You know, why are we sending people to Mars? Let's just send them to hardware. It rolls around Mars for, you know, years at a time, and you know, doesn't need to come back, and it doesn't need all the usual things you need for human life and all that stuff, and it's not dangerous. That's all true. On the other hand, for example, if you're looking for life on Mars, well, it's said that a human geologist would be going through the rocky landscape there at least 10 times faster than any rover could. And so, you know, it might be that there are just a lot of jobs for which humans are still really much better when it comes to exploring something like the surface of Mars. But I think that the real issue is not so much that. I think the real issue is this. We want to go to Mars partly because we just, you know, that's sort of wired into us. But it's also the case that within 50 years, 100 at the most, I think, we have to start getting some people off this planet, because either that or we have to, you know, kind of stagnate, because we obviously can't have an indefinite increase in the population. That's an old story. You know, there's some level of population where you say, you know, more than this, and we really can't support them on the planet. But also there are lots of problems with materials. There are things that you tend to run out of, and of course you'll recycle things, but there are things that you do use up. So at some point, either you start moving some of the population off the Earth, or you accept a stagnant society, and I think that's a dangerous society.
Maybe we can bring some resources to the Earth, like put some asteroids in orbit and start mining them. That could help.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. That's not a bad idea. And of course, the moon is not a bad source of some things. I mean, if you just need stuff for building, for example, rotating aluminum cans in space, an idea that's, as it were, been floating around for at least 35 years now. There's plenty of aluminum on the moon, and plenty of bauxite anyhow, and there's plenty of solar energy. You can make, I don't know whether it made it into the final article or not, but I had suggested in the original version of that article that appeared in the New York Times that I could imagine the moon is becoming, if you will, like China, a big manufacturing base. And, you know, the products are just sent to the Earth. But that's for the future, but not the distant future. That's all foreseeable.
Yeah. Right. So you defined the debate, but you didn't really take a side. I'm curious if you think that it's worth the investment to put people into space, even if it's just in our solar system.
I think in our solar system it is. And let me just give you a really simple reason. You talk to kids. You know, you say, well, would you like to be involved in a project to send motorized skateboards to Mars, or would you like to go to Mars?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. There's a difference in motivation there.
I agree. I'm totally in your camp on that. Although, just to say what the other side is, I think we had Bob Park on our show, and he said that the next generation, these kids that we're talking about, are going to be very comfortable experiencing the world virtually. And just as you were talking about having a virtual presence via these robots and other solar systems, kids, you know, the next generation, you know, sending a robot, being virtually on Mars, maybe they will be good with that.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because, of course, it's simpler. There are a lot of worlds in our own solar system, of course, that really you can't send people to. You're not going to send people to the surface of Jupiter, for example. But what if you want to just walk around the surface of Venus? Well, that's tough if you're going to do it with real people, because it's pretty toasty on Venus, right? A robotic craft could do it, and you just build up this huge database. I mean, it's sort of like, do you want to be a car thief? You know, well, Grand Theft Auto, you can be a car thief without actually landing in jail. So here you can explore Venus without having your epidermis singed.
Right. Oh, there's definitely going to be a necessary role for robotic exploration. There's no question about that.
But then the big problem, that one that I was really, really depressed me for a while when I realized, I read that article in Scientific American about just getting humans to Mars. The cosmic rays and the solar radiation would just fry the astronauts, and they've got to figure out either how to get shielding around the ship, which would be, of course, very expensive with the launch costs.
Well, it's certainly true that you have that danger. How dangerous it is somewhat controversial. You can, you know, read Bob Zubrin's books on this, and he doesn't think it's quite the problem that a lot of other people do, and he says one thing you can do is you put a sort of a storm cellar on board your rocket to Mars, right, which is sort of a closet that's, you know, kind of small, but lead-lined or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see the solar storm coming, and you get some advance warning because you can see optically that there's a flare on the sun before the particles arrive. So you have, you know, some time there. And then you just duck into this storm cellar and you wait it out, and it takes a couple of hours before it passes. And then, okay, maybe it's not very comfy in there, but on the other hand, you could do it.
But what about the cosmic radiation, though? You couldn't predict the cosmic radiation.
No, cosmic radiation is sort of this steady drip, if you will, and that's, except it's not a drip. It's sort of a hard splash. there is the question of how dangerous that is, you know, and it's certainly something that needs to be looked at. If it requires that you shield the ship, you know, all the time, well, that's tough. But I don't think that that's considered a real showstopper, this radiation. I mean, it's going to make a problem for you on Mars if you're living there, because now you've got to be indoors a lot and all that stuff. But, you know, there are other ways to beat that. You just have to fix Mars. But that's a bigger project.
Seth, one last question. You were the technical advisor for the recent movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That sounds like it was a lot of fun.
Well, it was a lot of fun, actually. I greatly enjoyed it. I thought I was one of many technical advisors, but I'm not sure that's true, actually. Given to understand that I was the technical advisor for, you know, the astrobiology and the astronomy and whatever, and in particular the scene with the Klaatu, played by Keanu Reeves, and the earthly scientist, Professor Barnhart, played by John Cleese. I was up there when they were shooting the scene where these two guys duel it out on a blackboard with equations. In fact, I wrote all the equations on the board.
Huh.
Yeah, that's all my handwriting.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I read that they were asking you questions about life, the universe, and everything.
Well, that was between takes. You see, I was standing around with Cleese and Keanu Reeves, and Jennifer Connelly was also on the set. She's very nice.
Is she as gorgeous as she seems?
Well, I'll tell you. I looked up pictures of her before I went up there. I had talked to her on the phone several times because she plays an astrobiologist. She wanted some background there. So I went up there, and I met her for the first time, and she doesn't look like the pictures. She's 10 times better than the pictures.
Oh, my God.
But in any case, Cleese and Reeves were standing around, and and Jennifer Connelly was off to the side. They asked me, they said, "Now, Seth, we're here for a purpose, aren't we? We're here for a reason, aren't we?" And I wasn't sure why they were asking me, because, you know, why should I know?
Well, you didn't tell them, did you?
Well, that's, I did tell them something. They were asking me, I figured they suspected, well, if you're an astronomer and you deal with big stuff, you know, you obviously know the meaning of life. I don't follow the logic, but somehow there's some logic in there. What I said was, I replied to Cleese, I think, and I said, "Well, John, if you'd asked the question 100 million years ago, the answer would be, you're just a dinosaur." You know, so I don't think that the answer today would be really much different, except that you're just a hominid.
Right.
I love that answer. That's great.
They didn't love it.
No, I think a lot of people wouldn't like that, but hey, that's... You're just a hominid.
Yeah.
And Seth, when you do find definitive proof of alien signal from outer space, you'll come on our show to talk to us about it, right?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'll be sitting around, you know, buffing my nails, but I...
Yeah, you won't be busy if that happens.
Yeah, you really know the meaning of life then.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, maybe they'll tell us, huh?
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Seth.
Thanks,
Seth. Okay, thank you, guys.
It's time for Science or... Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone
okay.
ready?
Si, senora.
Steve, we're ready. Let's do
it. Okay, here we go. Item number one. New research shows that chewing gum is associated with higher academic performance in teens. Item number two, computer scientists have developed a system for automatic lip reading that is greater than 95% accurate after minimal training. And item number three, engineers have developed a medical ultrasound device that works with a smartphone. Rebecca, go first.
Okay, so new research shows that chewing gum is associated with higher academic performance in teens. That makes sense to me, because I also know that I've heard that there's studies that have shown that fiddling with something or doodling can actually help you pay more attention to, say, a boring meeting or something like that. So maybe in that respect it could help. Computer scientists have developed a system for automatic lip reading that is greater than 95% accurate after minimal training. That one seems suspicious to me, because lip reading... I don't know. That seems like it would be a highly complex thing, because you have to look at a lot of different parts of the mouth, the tongue, and, I don't know, syntax, put it all together with the language. That seems tricky. Engineers have developed a medical ultrasound device that works with a smartphone. I have no idea what that even means. Like, what does that mean?
So you know what ultrasound is?
Yeah.
Like look at babies, you know, and pregnant women.
So but why would you need that on your smartphone?
Like an iPhone.
If you're Tom Cruise and you want to monitor your feet inside your young impregnated wife.
Not necessarily about function, right?
So the idea is that you take a smartphone and you stick it up against a pregnant woman's stomach and you can see the baby. Is that the idea?
Close. The idea is you attach this portable ultrasound device to a smartphone, and then the smartphone acts as
the monitor.
The monitor, yeah.
Ah. Oh, well, yeah, that sounds perfectly useless in a way, but okay. But plausible. So I'm going to say that automatic lip reading, that seems way out there to me. I'll say that that's the fiction.
Okay, Jay?
New research shows that chewing gum is associated with higher academic performance in teens. You know, the first thing that I thought of when you read that, Steve, was that, I mean, is it possible that chewing gum, you know, what does it do? It stimulates the production of saliva, and then you're swallowing. You know, I don't think it really increases your heart rate at all. But I don't know. There's something about it that seems like it might stimulate something that could have that effect. That's something there that's I'm curious about. The second one, computer scientists have developed a system for automatic lip reading that is greater than 95% accurate after minimal training. Seems possible, right? 95% accurate lip reading. I'm paying attention to my mouth as it's moving right now, and I don't know. I don't know about that one. Number three, engineers have developed a medical ultrasound device that works with a smartphone. I absolutely believe that. Something about the second one, the lip reading one that I don't like, so I'm going to say that one's a fake.
Okay, Bob?
The chewing gum, yeah, it sounds plausible that that if you occupy yourself in that way of whether it's chewing gum or even just tapping a foot or this incessant movement, it kind of makes sense that you could possibly focus a little better. So that kind of makes sense to me. Number three, the ultrasound device working with a smartphone. Yeah, that makes total sense. It's a great idea to utilize these utilize the smartphones with these portable devices. I mean, everyone's got the phones with the little screen on it. So why not use that? Could really help increase the penetration and availability of this technology. The second one here about the automatic lip reading. 95% definitely sounds too high to me. I don't think even people who've grown up and are familiar with the language would achieve 95% with minimal training. Yeah, that's just too high. There's just so much variation in the way people enunciate and move their lips. I think that if they hit 80%, that would be good. So I'm going to say that is false.
Okay, Evan?
Chewing gum associated with higher academic performance in teens.
Hang on. I just wanted to point out that Bob used the word probe and penetrate, and Jay just totally didn't pick up on it. But go ahead, Evan.
Jay, you feeling okay?
Chewing gum, higher academic performance, and walking skills. All correct. Next. Engineers developing a medical ultrasound working with a smartphone. Yes. And, therefore, the automatic lip reader, 95% accurate. Bob's right, way too high, 95% accuracy. So many different shapes, too many different forms, lips, ways people talk. I mean, it's the variations just seem almost endless, and to get it 95% accurate would be astounding, almost
all right.
Implausible.
So. Okay, so you all agree that new research shows that chewing gum is associated with higher academic performance in teens. And that one is science.
Yay.
Research was conducted at Baylor College of Medicine, indicates a positive effect from chewing gum on academic performance in teenagers. They had higher standardized math test scores, and their final grades were better compared to those who didn't chew gum. And it is that the idea is in previous research suggests that chewing gum helps reduce stress, improve alertness, and relieve anxiety. Therefore, you can concentrate better. But I do have to say, guess who funded this research?
Wrigley's.
Trident.
The Wrigley Science Institute.
Yeah.
There you go.
Oh, God.
Take that for what it's worth. Mm-hmm. This is what they write. Wrigley is committed to advancing and sharing scientific research that explores the benefits of chewing gum. I bet they are.
Yeah, no. Wow. Another Kellogg's.
So I am a gum chewer. I like to chew gum.
Me too.
And it saddens me to think that if I stopped chewing gum, I'd be a little dumber now.
You didn't realize it was a crutch.
Yeah.
Number two, computer scientists have developed a system for automatic lip reading that is greater than 95% accurate after minimal training. You guys all thought that that one was the fiction, and that one is the fiction.
Yeah.
Good job. How far along do you think this technology is?
I don't think it's even in its infancy.
Accurate.
No, I think it's beyond its infancy. I would say they could probably get 75% accurate with more than minimal training.
The highest I found was 50%.
Wow.
50%. And the news item that triggered this as the fiction was a breakthrough where they were able to train a automatic lip reading, of course, using a video camera.
Different languages,
to,
right?
Yeah, to a computer to try to have a computer do lip reading, which would be great for surveillance. I mean, just imagine in any place where you have any security surveillance, you can actually tell what people are saying.
Your buddy Jack comes up and you go, "Hi, Jack."
The cops.
Exactly.
Bob, you're such a... But the new little breakthrough was that they were able to get the software to tell what language somebody was speaking. Not what they were saying, but what language they were speaking. And, and supports the belief that, you know, different languages would have different combinations of mouth movements and tongue movements that were typical of them. So we'll see. We'll see. There are programs that think that within a few years they might have something usable, something in, you know, over the 90% accuracy range. You know, you never know. Again, it's hard to predict these things.
Which means
engineers have developed a medical ultrasound device that works with a smartphone is science.
Yeah,
this little doohickey is pretty cool. It's that they had to really miniaturize it and really change everything about how the ultrasounds work so that they would be compatible with a smartphone. But they did it. Plug it in there, and then you got a little portable ultrasound. It's cool. You should see the pictures of it.
What about the adapter, Steve? Is it tied to one specific brand of smartphone?
USB.
Nice.
Oh, it's wow. Cool.
Oh, USB. Awesome.
Hey, you think you could like hook up an EKG machine or something to your smartphone and get readings on that?
The bottom line is that a smartphone is powerful enough now that it could pretty much do any of these things as long as you had the adapter, as long as it could, you had
the
a
software.
Device. Yeah, the software and you had a compatible device to a peripheral, you know, device to hook into it. It's the, you know, I don't think you're going to be doing MRIs anytime soon, you know, with a smartphone. But EKG is nothing. EEG, you know, digital EEG, you know, any of these little digital things you could do, absolutely. This, of course, would have a lot of applications in the field.
And
you
cost
know.
Savings, too.
Imagine, I mean, we are getting closer and closer to the Dr. McCoy medical device where you wave it over somebody. and you get that.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, honestly.
It's awesome.
15, 20 years ago, there was things in science fiction that just seemed so far out there and so like, oh yeah, as if.
Mm. Yeah.
And look at what's going on today.
It is pretty exciting.
Tiny device. Yeah.
I kind of blew it off as being useless, but that's only from a first world perspective, I think. But reconsidering it, something like that would be very handy for, say, doctors in third world countries that are traveling around and need to do on the fly inspections of pregnant women. That I imagine that could really come in handy.
But not only would this have greater penetration into areas where they don't have a lot of medical technology, but also once you get something that is that portable, where you know you could actually have it in your jacket pocket, and it's affordable, then you'd think of new ways to use it that you wouldn't have thought of before. So one of the things, for example, that was suggested in this article is you could use it to image veins when putting in an IV.
Whoa.
Or doing little procedures where we do it blinded. You know, you do it just by feel and using the surface anatomy, and you could do it okay. But if you could have a little portable device to actually to see what you were doing, it would make the procedure a little bit easier. It's not worth carrying around an ultrasound machine to do this, but if you could have it on your smartphone, it would be worth it, you know?
Yeah, but you still have to attach the smartphone to an external device.
Yeah, but it's tiny. It's tiny. It's this little handheld probe, you know? And then pretty soon with this lip reading technology, you're going to have Hal reading your lips in the pod. Remember that?
Rotate the pod, please, Hal.
That was a very creepy part of that movie of 2001.
It's like my favorite part of that movie.
Holy, that Hal is reading their lips.
And how Kubrick, you know, shot that and edited that was brilliant.
It was brilliant.
But the thing is, though, Steve, that wasn't Hal inspired by the race from the monolith? Like, you know, wasn't he? Was that still in question?
In 2001, Hal goes psychotic. It was left deliberately mysterious. We never were told, and there was never any reason why. In 2010, Arthur C. Clarke, on his own, provided an explanation, which was that Hal was told to lie to the crew, and that went against some of his more fundamental programming, so he became erratic because he was told to lie. But in 2001, it was left deliberately mysterious.
I like when it's left deliberately mysterious.
Yeah.
I mean, because you can talk about it for, you know, 30, 50, 40, 50 years later, right?
Right.
Would you like to hear a song? Daisy.
No, but I would like to hear Who's That Noisy?
Well, that's kind of a noisy.
Who's that noisy?
All right, but we should review last week's Who's That Noisy?
Yes.
And here it is.
We had no idea about how this stuff could be done. We're sort of like, where were people with gravity before Newton came along? I mean, gravity worked, clearly, but no one had an idea how. So similarly, here's some things that we saw worked and happened, but no idea how.
All right, Evan, and who was that?
And that was Dr. Hal Puthoff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like Targan Puthoff.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a zero-point energy guy.
And he's also the guy who got totally duped by Uri Geller.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally duped. So that's a rare recording of him, I guess. I'd never heard it before, so to me it was rare.
Rare to you. Well, but before we go on to this week, Jay, you have to tell us who your noisy was last week.
What it was.
Yeah, what the hell was
that? Well, to remind our listeners, the sound you heard was this.
All right, we got it.
You got it?
Yeah.
That's Jim Carrey in his latest role. Squirrel Boy.
This interesting device was made by humans. It is a dolphin pen.
Yeah.
Somebody actually got that, I think.
Somebody got it, yeah.
Infamous Tom, somebody did get it.
Who?
Some guy.
What's this, a podcast?
It's not the man who's that noisy, so he doesn't get his name said. But congratulations, guy.
Well done, Homo sapien.
Okay, so that was my who's that noisy. I actually enjoyed that, Evan. I think you have a fun job there.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it is a lot of fun.
So what's this week's?
And people are enjoying it, I think, as well. So here's this week's who's that noisy. Get ready.
Okay, that was creepier than the dolphin pen.
All right. So, play it back a few times and rack your brains and throw out your best guess.
Thanks, Evan.
Enjoy.
Thank you, Evan. Jay, what quote you got for us tonight?
I have, how about Mark Twain?
All righty.
Love him.
Mark Twain said or wrote, I don't know if he said or wrote, I think he wrote this one.
Probably also said it at some point.
There is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment effect. Mark Twain!
He was the goods man.
Yeah. So I have a couple of announcements. We've been getting a lot of people that use the Zune that are having problems with the podcasts, and Jeremy and I have been working on it. And I'm telling you, this one was a big pain in the ass, but I think the solution is that all they need to do is unsubscribe to the show and resubscribe to both podcasts if you're listening to both. But just resubscribe to whatever podcast you're listening to, and that'll repoint it to the correct feed. Please try that. If anyone's having a problem after they do that, send me an email from the site to webmaster.
The feed is updating.
Yeah, the feed is. We did change our feed. The feed is different as of the new website. That's that. They have to point to the new feed.
Yeah.
So the easiest thing they could do is just delete their whole subscription and restart their subscription, and that should fix it. Sorry, really sorry, guys. We didn't want to change our feed address, but we needed to.
I have an announcement. First of all, Boston Skeptics in the Pub is this Monday, April 27th, and our special guests are Jeffrey Rowland, who draws the overcompensating webcomic, and his buddy John Rosenberg, who draws goats. Those are two really popular, very sciencey, very geeky, skeptical webcomics. So it's going to be a really fun show this time around. Info on that is at bostonskeptics.com, as always. And also, I was on another podcast that's going live soon. It's at doublefeatureshow.com. And it's this fun movie-related podcast, and they had me on to talk about Loose Change, and so that was fun and a bit infuriating because it's Loose Change.
Mm-hmm.
9/11 conspiracy theories, all that. So, but it was a good time, so I highly recommend people check it out.
Excellent.
That is all.
I have an announcement.
Okay, Evan.
Yes.
The person on the message board who correctly guessed Jay's Who's That Noisy was James01.
James01.
Thanks, James.
Good one.
James Mason.
Steve. Oh, I love that.
Thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mason.
Thank
and
you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.